With everyone fighting for attention, how can your business stand out and connect with customers? Easy, with Constant Contact. Constant Contact's award-winning marketplace platform has helped millions of small businesses stand out, stay top of mind, and see big results fast. It's okay if you don't know much about marketing. Constant Contact's writing assistant tools and automation features help you craft messaging and say the right things at the right time. I use this to help write and send my email newsletters, and you should too. So get going and start growing your business today with a free trial at ConstantContact.com. Just go to ConstantContact.com right now. Constant Contact, helping the small stand tall. ConstantContact.com.
My name is Jari Bolander. Welcome to the Entrepreneur Ethos Podcast. On this podcast, we're going to take a deep dive into the traits, values, beliefs, and skills of all sorts of entrepreneurs to learn how to build a more ethical, inclusive, and resilient world. Let's get started. Today, I talk with John Burton, who has been on and off the entrepreneurial track, but definitely now prefers to be an entrepreneur. John started his career as an electrical engineer and was tapped to run a startup in Ireland, where he learned how to build a company from the ground up. He's founded and ran several businesses, most recently a fast-growing software services company, which he co-founded with two Apple veterans called Ursilio. Ursilio comes from the central idea of a company providing a digital twin that allows for virtual monitoring. Ursilio is uniquely positioned to help companies manage buildings in the time of social distancing with the use of 3D technologies. John is finding that some companies are eager to use this time to implement new processes and strategies, proving that there may be some hope for a quick rebounding of the economy. John has seen his fair share of dealing with hard times, having had to settle in mediation with a former partner at his old company. He talks candidly about how he handles stress and how yoga and classical guitar are keys to helping him get through his day. Now, let's get better together. John Burton, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, really, really appreciate you taking the time. And, you know, you're another one of the fellow founder network folk that I'm trying to get to know. Yep. And I'm actually super curious about the company that you're working on because it's got a bunch of 3D, you know, like, instrumentation and virtual stuff. It just so blew my mind when I was looking up the website. I think it's called Ursilio, which we'll get to in a second about what that means and all that. But kind of before we do that, I'd love to hear about your entrepreneur journey and sort of how you got to do what you're doing.
Sure. No, thanks very much. Yeah, so I grew up in the UK, obviously, as you can probably gather from my accent. Did an electronic engineering degree at the University of Birmingham and went to work for Marconi Radar in the UK and really, really hated it. Now, this was back when engineering was done in little, those World War II huts, you know, the sort of semicircular huts.
Yeah, the Kwanzaa huts. Yeah.
Kwanzaa huts. Yeah, and they were left over from World War II. And the whole thing was bureaucratic and boring. And so didn't really enjoy that. Kicked around a couple of other jobs in the UK and then got the opportunity to go to Ireland and start a company, a fairly large group called Memec. They're not around anymore. Basically, I was about 26, and they gave me, I think, $500,000, sent me to Ireland and told me to start a company, which I did. And it was, you know, it was moderately successful. This was back when Ireland was really booming. It was the Celtic Tiger time. So I did that for a few years and really enjoyed it. I mean, it was very, very hard, as anyone who's been an entrepreneur knows. Kind of cashed that in 98, 99, moved back to the UK and started working for this big company who had funded me, and they funded me to, you know, it's like a skunk works. They funded it and then they bought it. So worked for them for a few years, moved to the US to San Diego with them. And I'm just not a big company guy. I think that's what I realized once I'd done the entrepreneur thing and then the big company thing. I'm just not good at office politics. I have a tendency to say what I mean a bit too much. Especially when you go to San Diego and, you know, you're on the West Coast.
Yes.
So I didn't do terribly well as a, you know, working inside the big company. Then they got bought out in 2005, So I took seven other people from the company. We started another company. That didn't go very well. It sort of fell apart in 2008. But being a glutton for punishment, I went and started another company in 2008.
That's a tough one. Yeah. 2008, yeah. Not a good time to raise money for sure.
I was raising money. We were actually in the hotel watching the stock market go off a cliff the day before we did raise some money.
Oh, wow.
We didn't get a very good deal, but we did raise money, which was the main objective. So that one fairly well. And I sold that in 2011 to a Japanese company. And by that time, I was, 42, 43, somewhere around there, and decided that was it. I was done with this entrepreneur thing. It's too hard. I'll just work for these Japanese guys. I was running the Americas. They were paying me well, and did that up until 2016 and just couldn't do it anymore. And I'm like, I just one more trip to Japan and one more day of sitting in pointless meetings, listening to boring presentations. I just can't do it. I had a good friend of mine who just left Apple. She left Apple in 2015, I think. And she was sort of kicking around looking for something to do. So late 2016, I approached her, and we started this in early 2017. That's how we got to this company. And this one's going really well.
I'm wow. pleased to say. That's great. No, that's really great. I mean, it sounds like a similar journey to that I have, where kicked around on some corporate stuff and then just decided I cannot drink any more bad corporate coffee because it's just too much. And I was, I had the same problem you did, where I would speak my mind, and apparently people don't really like to hear that, or.
But they all have the culture that, we encourage complete transparency and openness, unless you actually do it, at which point we're going to slap you down as hard, it's not a big fan of the culture.
Yeah. I worked at Cypress Semiconductor. And they had they had a saying there, and it was like, "We deplore politicians," but they never told you what was in quotes, but only the bad ones. Because I was a horrible politician, I thought, "Oh, I just tell the truth what I'm doing." I was so naive; I had no idea that was just sort of bullshit. That really the hierarchy of a company, you have to play the political game, even when they say you don't play the political game. And I just remember.
Was that the T.J. Rogers day?
Oh, yeah. No. I would routinely get yelled at him. He would yell at me, every month or so.
He's yelled at me before. I mean, he's yelled at everybody. I mean,
yeah. Everyone's always like, every time anyone quote unquote chews me out or like it's a little bit heated and they're like, "Oh, I'm so sorry. I was probably a bit offensive." I'm like, "No, you have not been yelled at until TJ Rogers looks you in the eye and says so many four letter words that you just can't even, you just got to walk out." Right. I mean,
yeah, that first generation semiconductor guys, there's a bunch of real characters in there.
Not even political correctness, soft skills. I mean, they would be like, "Soft skills? What are you, impotent?" I mean, that's how they would like think about it. And, I have this great TJ story where I was running a project and it was really going awful. And he literally kicked our entire team out and literally said, "You have 30 days to live. If you don't fix this problem, I'm going to fire all of you." And there was probably like 50 or 60 of us. And I mean, just devastated. I'm like, "Oh man, I am not going to go anywhere." Right. And so the next day he sends an email. He's like, "You have 29 more days left. I hope you use your first day wisely."
management by intimidation and fear. Yeah. I mean, we don't get much of that anymore.
No. And so that was the day I realized I'm no longer going to work here. I'm like, I'm done. And that's a very, there was a lot more four letter acronyms and expletives that I won't get into because this is a kind of a family show, but oh man. Yeah. Corporate is just, I mean, the people that can do it, that can thrive, great. But boy, if I had to sit into another root cause corrective action meeting, we had to sit there and pretty much like beat each other up on how we screwed up. I'm just like, I'm done. This is no more.
Yeah.
So.
No, I've seen the skill set that survives and I'm not it.
So. Yeah. Me neither.
I'm better at doing this stuff.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. So, wow. I mean, that's a great kind of intro to kind of like your journey and a lot of the same you know, I think it's a common thing among entrepreneurs where we sort
it's
of
a sickness.
It's definitely a sickness. That is so true. That is so true. So tell us a little bit what Ursa Leo is up to.
So yeah, I in 2016 I was thinking about leaving Matnica, which was the Japanese company I was with, and I knew Angie Stitcher personally pretty well. Angie was ex-Apple. She spent 10 years there, ran the core operating system team through the iPhone, launched through iPhone 6. And yeah, I got together with her in a front room in early 2017 and said, I'm right on the point of leaving. How about we do something in software? The cloud sounds like it's got a lot of, you know, a lot of growth. Let's put a business together that does cloud. So that was literally we didn't have really an idea at that point. Then we started, you know, poking around, looking what to do. And I had quite a good background in IoT, Internet of Things, mostly from the hardware side. So I knew that was a really good growth market. I also knew industrial companies really struggled with it because they're not used to doing cloud software type stuff. So we focused on that. And then the third member of the team, Jason Gosnell, joined us, another ex-Apple guy, and he really got us focused in on 3D visualizations and using three-dimensional technology to improve the user interface for the Internet of Things, which sounds a bit weird, esoteric. But if you think about, you know, computers have gone from point and click to touch screens to voice control. The industrial world is still very much point and click. Mm-hmm. So we're doing a lot of human machine interface that helps people interact with large amounts of data much more efficiently.
Wow. I do some IoT stuff through Lab Sensor and yeah, it's awful. All the interfaces are just crazy, crazy bad.
Yeah, especially when you get a few thousand data points flying around, and that's where we really start to shine.
Yeah, because I mean, I guess a lot of people don't know about like an industrial complex. The amount of like gauges and dials and things that could go wrong is just, I mean, it's astronomical. What kind of benefit do you guys get from like using your platform? I mean, how is it like? I mean, people are going to need to know, I guess, a little bit about how like it kind of works, because when I looked at the demo online, it just blew me away and I don't even know what you do. It was like, this is really cool.
Okay. I mean, I'll stop me if I go too technical, but basically we begin by creating a 3D model of what you want to monitor. And that can be a piece of equipment. It can be a facility. Right now, we're very busy in building management because a lot of people are now getting very interested about who's walking into buildings. Are they wearing a mask? How many people are in a room? So we would start by creating a model of that facility or a model of the piece of equipment. We're actually using gaming technology. So the stuff you looked at online, that was all rendered using the Unity gaming engine. So we usually take a CAD file, computer-aided design file. And most companies have those for their buildings and for their equipment. We strip it down. We put some colors and textures on it. We create something that's pretty photorealistic. And then we combine that with whatever sensor data they're already collecting. And then we also pull in data typically from asset databases, maintenance databases. So if you're not familiar with industrial, you know, you've got sensors reading things like temperature, humidity, pressure. You've also got a database that tells you when the equipment was installed, what version of the equipment is, when it was maintained. You've got maintenance records, what they actually did when they were doing maintenance. So all of that data is usually sitting in different databases and usually has to be looked up, you know, using different interfaces. We pull it all into one place and combine it with this 3D model. So the advantage is that there's a lot, actually. We keep finding new ones. First, you get all your data in one place and you get your data in a way that's very easy to understand. Industrial world, you often have, you know, operators who've been doing the same job for 20, 30 years. You give them a sort of abstract dashboard. They're not necessarily going to be very comfortable with it. They're pretty comfortable with something that looks exactly like their machinery, except it's got a bunch of sensor information on it. Once you've done that, you know, got that going, then you get into things like online collaboration. So an expert sitting in Denver can be looking at what we call it, the 3D model. We call it digital twin sometimes. The expert in Denver is looking at the digital twin while the guy in North Dakota is working on the actual piece of equipment. And he's seeing exactly what the guy's doing. He's seeing the temperature change, the pressure change. He's seeing, you know, potentially pieces of the equipment moving around. So he can get a lot, he can get a lot done remotely than normally he'd actually have to travel to. So that's a couple of the type of applications we do. More data, remote collaboration, lots of other things as well.
Yeah. I mean, if you were to, I think the way that I was sort of thinking about it is that if you, let's see, what was that one movie where, you kind of, well, there's been a bunch of movies where people would like open up in some sort of VR thing and like move their hands. Yeah. Right. Like that. just not as evil.
We're not far away. Yeah. No, we do some stuff in VR, virtual reality.
Yeah.
We are looking at things like voice control. So we're not far away from somebody walking into a manufacturing plant with an iPad and saying, show me all the pressure readings within 50 feet. And you know, within a few months, probably we'll be able to have a 3D model of the facility appear on his iPad with those pressure readings on it.
Yeah. And I think the thing that's really cool about this, that of course, you know, because of COVID and everything, the whole idea of sort of remote, being able to manipulate things remotely and like having the experience like you're walking through it, but you're not really physically there. Mm-hmm. Boy, what a like huge opportunity to kind of figure out how those new kind of workflows or you know, like it's just interesting because a lot of this industrial stuff. And the only reason why I know about this is because when I was at Cypress, they had this place called Cypress Microsystems, or I don't remember the name of it, but what they did was they would take Cypress semiconductor chips, build little boards, and like build like applications that mm-hmm. using all the technology that Cypress had built. And one of the applications was a camera that would suction cup onto a gauge, like a pressure gauge, like literally an analog gauge, like the old ones you'd see, like a speedometer or something. And they would suck these. They literally were like suction cups onto these gauges, and then there would be a little camera. We'd take a picture of it and then send it back and do stuff. So mm-hmm. what they were trying to do was get all of those manual gauges to be on the internet, basically.
Yep.
And the reason is that if you've ever walked into an industrial plant, it's literally like, imagine the Starship Enterprise with just dials and gauges, like the old exactly. NASA stuff. And yep. they could never, like, you know, you kind of wonder why, you know, they had to. But so it sounds like this is something similar. Is it, when it comes to an office space, like you mentioned yep. that you want people to sort of see who's going in and out with masks or density or whatever. Mm-hmm. What kind of sensors do you like, do they have some, or do you have to like instrument the place? Or I'm curious, cause like not a lot of folks, like at least a lot of things that I know about, have sensors in place already.
So modern office buildings typically will, that there's some certifications you can get when you put, you know, what they call smart building technology in around energy, energy usage. So you office buildings and lease office buildings typically do have smart technology, mainly because they get more money for the lease because the buildings are more energy efficient. So typically they'll already have temperature, humidity. They'll be monitoring the HVACs. What we're doing right now is more around social distancing. So there we're adding, you know, typically a camera looking at the lobby door, which can detect if someone's wearing a mask or not as they come in. And that's not our tech. That's some third-party artificial intelligence that we're partnering with. And then the other thing we're adding is indoor positioning technology. So when you pick up your visitor badge, it's actually an RF tag. And it's emitting a Bluetooth-like signal. And then with, you know, two or three sensors per couple of thousand square foot, you can get pretty good accuracy as to where people are, about plus or minus a meter. So once you add that into, you know, your overall office management, the new stuff we're adding is typically the social distancing stuff, the temperature, humidity stuff's usually already there. And then we model the whole building as a 3D, 3D model and display all of this stuff in a 3D environment.
And so like the people that would use obviously your technology are these building maintenance and the company to make sure they're compliant or just more efficient operations or something, or?
little bit of both. So typically they're already, like I say, they already have sensors. They already have a control room. The user interface is usually so horrible, though, that they're very badly used. I've got a good architect friend who's actually on our board of directors, and he tells me stories regularly that, you know, they spent a ton of money installing these smart sensors, and then they go back 3 months later, and the guy who's running the building is using a clipboard. But certainly they'll you know, we're using it for building efficiency. And now we're starting to work, especially in the healthcare industry, where they've got a lot of people coming in and out. And obviously some of those people are going to be sick, because that's the reason they're going to a healthcare facility. They really want to be able to, you know, enforce masks, enforce measure people's temperature, and then and enforce social distancing. So that's kind of an add-on stuff that we're doing for them.
Yeah, well, I could definitely see how that could be a big growth area, because a lot of people that I've talked to, when it comes to opening a city up, or, you know, like just the compliance to the protocol, because, you know, the stuff that we were doing, or that we do at Lab Sensor, is basically compliance to where things are and what their temperature may be. And it's always surprising that they're like, yeah, we got a process, it works. And then literally you can walk around and see, no, you're dependent on people. Mm-hmm. People make mistakes, and people will never be as accurate as a system and a process that's automated, that all it does is just figure this stuff out. So yeah, I could see this being a big step in helping not only companies, but people feel comfortable, you know, that they're...
Yeah, exactly. We can have a big screen in the lobby that sort of displays what's going on in the whole building if they want.
Wow. Wow. So throughout this sort of eclectic journey that you've been on, what do you sort of do on a daily basis that kind of sets you up for success? Or like, are there any kind of things that just like help you with all this? Because it, you know, we have a tough job, you know?
Yeah. It's a roller coaster. I mean, that's probably the biggest challenge for me is the emotional, you know, I have a good sales call or a good partnership call or a great technology call, and I'm, you know, on cloud nine. Then you have a, you know, a call where it doesn't go so well. The investor doesn't give you the money. And you're down in the depths immediately. So that's probably, I think that's pretty common for, you know, people doing what we're doing. It's very tough to manage that. You know, the only thing you can manage is your reaction to it. So I'm kind of into things like yoga, classical guitar playing. I actually went and studied classical guitar in Paraguay once for about 6 weeks.
Oh, wow.
Did nothing but play classical guitar all day, every day, which I got pretty good at playing the guitar. Well, not that good anymore. It wears off if you don't keep it up. A little bit of sports and activity. Not as much as I'd like, because I think one of the other things I struggle with is putting it down and going, hey, it's okay to take the weekend off. You know, the thing isn't going to die because you didn't sit in front of your computer Saturday and Sunday answering emails. So I think if I had to give myself advice 2 years ago, you know, make sure you do take time off. I'm much better at it now because things have reached a point where I can relax a little bit. But yeah, yoga's great because it start the day with that. It completely sort of takes the stress out. I usually break my day up by doing 10-minute sessions on the guitar. My wife's been very supportive, although stressed her out a little bit as well doing this whole thing.
Oh yeah.
But it's it's tough. Yeah. If you don't like stress, then this is not the job to do.
Yeah.
Go and do something well paid.
Yeah. And low stress. Yeah. And hopefully, yeah. So yeah, I always say it's like the difference between freedom and kind of, well, I don't want to call it money, but like you can get a good corporate job and get paid really well, but then you don't have freedom. But then you can mm-hmm. have freedom and not get paid very well, at least initially, right? We all hope that it'll grow and go nutty, but you know.
Yeah, I think once you start to get to that point, then you've got the best of both worlds. And that's kind of where we are now. It's going really well. We've raised money. We've got cash in the bank. We've got customers and I've got the freedom. So 3 years of hell to get there, but yeah.
Yeah. That sounds like you really are getting there. It's great to hear, because a lot of times it's tough to have that journey and not see any end result, or at least, you know, I mean, it's just the zigs and zags, they can be really hard on people.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
And I'm glad to hear that you, so you play classical guitar. Is there like a style of classical guitar? I don't know anything about classical guitar, so I'm just curious.
So classical guitar is a style of guitar. So this would be the Segovias, the John Williams, the guys who one foot's on a stool. It's a nylon strung acoustic guitar. You have your fingernails are pretty long. So you're picking the notes, typically using your fingernails. To get some volume and get some articulation on the note. And then I read music at a pretty good standard. So I don't want to sound pretentious, but I sort of relax or break my day up by sight reading Bach on the classical guitar, which is a completely different set of your brain to doing emails or, sales calls. And really sort of mellows me out and it just gives me something. It's intellectually challenging. It's fun to do. It's great to make progress at it. And it's also the opposite of what you're doing your 9-to-5 job.
So it's like, do you just schedule like I'm going to do 10 minutes or is it like, oh, I'm so fed up with these stupid emails. I'm just going to like stop, pick the guitar up and kind of start strumming.
I'm not really strumming very much. But it's. I find the day goes in natural sort of cycles. You finish that big presentation you've been working on for 2 hours. You got to take a break. So 10-15 minutes of guitar is a good way to do it. So I don't sort of schedule it, but I do find that you can only concentrate on one thing for so long, and your productivity drops off quite fast if you try and overdo it.
Yeah, I found that too. I think maybe it's. Just because I'm getting older too, maybe. I don't know what it is, but there's definitely a natural rhythm to the world. And so are you an early riser or you just sort of wake up when you wake up?
Well, I've got a lot of stuff going on in Europe. So very often we have calls, 7 a.m., 8 a.m. And I like to have an hour or so to sort of, wake up, do a little bit of yoga if I can, get myself ready. So I'm usually up around, fairly early, 6-ish. Getting enough sleep, I'd say, is another great big, really important one. And there was a time there where the stress was, meant you wake up in the middle of the night and your mind's whirring. So it's great to sort of move on from that phase. But yeah, pretty early riser, usually up around 6-ish.
Yeah. I mean, I know some people have like a natural, wake up rhythm. I know some people that they'll work till like 2 a.m. Then, they'll get up at, they'll do software engineering hours, right? They'll get up at 10 or 11.
Yeah. Our CTO does an awful lot of work between sort of, 1 a.m. and 4. He seems to be up doing code a lot of the time around then.
Yeah. Well, it just depends on your rhythm, the rhythm, the rhythm of each person, I think, is one of the other things that sometimes can be challenging running a company. Have you found that the different work styles, do you guys kind of mesh with your founders on how you make decisions, how you talk? Is it just sort of a natural way it fell in, or did you guys have to work at it?
It's pretty natural. I really like the Apple culture. I hadn't spent a lot of time around Apple people professionally before this. One of my big hatreds of big companies is too many meetings and too many pointless meetings and meetings that don't go anywhere and just sort of meander on because, hey, we're here. We might as well have a meeting and it feels like we're doing something. Apple doesn't do that. Apple, if you try and have a kind of wishy-washy meeting with the Apple guys, they'll walk out of the room. So they've got a very, very direct culture. I suspect that's one of the reasons the company's been as successful as it's been. I suspect that's why people tend to, 10 years is kind of a typical 10-year at Apple. But yes, they're very good from that point of view. They had to get used to the startup environment. They were both used to having significant resources around them that they just don't have now. And that was probably their big adjustment was, this is a startup. It's not Apple. We're going to bootstrap this one way or another. They've got a very high attention on quality. And that's actually worked really, really well because although we're a startup, what we have put out is very high quality. Great work ethic. Yeah. So I think 90% of the time we meshed really well. There's a no bullshit factor. The biggest challenges were getting them adapted to the startup environment and getting me adapted to a very, very regimented process driven way of doing things from an engineering perspective.
So like what kind of infrastructure were they used to that, I mean, I can imagine, but like, since it's been a while since I've been at a corporate environment for me, I just think that my life is my life, or my world's my world. What were some of the things that were hard for them to adjust to?
Well, typically at Apple, you would have one team who would do development, and then they would throw that over the wall to the Q&A team who would test it. At the same time, there's another team that's doing all the DevOps, keeping the servers up, standing up, making sure the actual deployment of the software and the workflow of the software is going smoothly. You know, so just you'd have you'd have four or five groups working on a product. We've got one. We've got the guys, we're doing development, but they're also kind of doing at least basic tests. And as we start to grow, we have to start dividing that up. You know, we're thinking about having a dedicated test group, fairly soon. DevOps, luckily, has been mostly automated by the cloud guys. So you can, that used to require somebody whose full-time job was just keeping servers updated and making everything run smoothly. A lot of that now you can sort of rely on Amazon or Azure or somebody to do it for you. But there was an adjustment there. They had to get used to, get used to write the code, test the code, deliver the code, make it work. UI is your job, user interface is your job as well as writing the code. So they just didn't have the segregation of responsibilities they had at Apple.
Yeah. I mean, I think I found that as well. Not so much like when my first startup I worked at? I don't remember, but there was definitely like the people that had worked at a big company were used to like, I remember one of them was like, oh, they're just used to like someone doing their expense report, right? Or something like silly like that, where you're like, yeah, yep. No, you don't have an admin. you are the admin.
Yeah. That's definitely a challenge. Who books my travel? You. Yeah. Who schedules my meetings? You.
Yeah.
Who takes the notes at meetings? That'd be you.
Yeah. 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 Well, or some people, I remember the thing that blew me away was that some people have, if they needed to do a slide deck, they have people that do their slide decks for them. And I'm all, you mean you don't do your slide decks yourself? So I go, no. So who's going to give me the deck? And I'm all, no, you're going to create the deck. No one's giving it to you.
But they've both been good. I mean, they're both real smart people. They're very, so yeah, we work really well as a team. I think we have regular, once a week meetings. We get together, we discuss everything openly, make, joint decisions on most things. Obviously some things I have to make the decision on. It's a great, really enjoying it. Great group of people to work with. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, that's really good. I think the most important thing is to have the people you're working with, you actually enjoy working with them. A lot of times when a startup goes south, it's because the co-founders have like some conflict. And I think it's usually around like work style and just vision and direction. So sounds like you really nailed that.
I went through the full gamut of that in 2011. We ended up in a mediation session and in a multi-million dollar settlement. And it's almost exactly what you just said. It all began with personality clash.
Wow. Wow. What was that? Which company was that?
So the company I was at, the big company that I moved to the US with, was called Memec, M-E-M-E-C. They were headquartered in San Diego. And then when they got bought, we spanned it out a company called Octera, because there was eight of us. So we put eight Octera and just put error on the end. And without going into gory details, the guy who was the CEO of that probably shouldn't have been the CEO. So myself, I went out and raised the money and sort of got the whole thing going. And I felt he just squandered that money, and I was the guy who had to go and talk to the investors about it. And it just, we started as good friends in 2005 or 2006, and we're in a mediation session in 2011, and I haven't spoken to him since. I mean, we really, it got quite bad.
Wow, that's a tough one. You hate to see that.
And it cost us $4 million.
Yeah, that's even worse. I mean, money's money, but like, losing the relationship or like having it sour over, business stuff is.
But I think you've got to go through one or two of those. I mean, I, you know, you run into younger founders who've never had any setbacks, and, you know, fingers crossed that'll be their whole career. But the reality is most people have setbacks in their, you know, even in a big company, you have setbacks, like you described with TJ Rogers, was, you know, putting the pressure on. Most people have setbacks, and it's really important to be able to deal with those and bounce back from it. You know, if you sit there blaming the rest of the world for what happened and chewing on it, you know, it can really knock you down for a long period of time.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, the training at Cypress was invaluable to be an entrepreneur. Because like I said, it's like, you know what? I've been yelled at by better. I've been told I'm an idiot by better, you know, that actual super smart people that are smarter than this knucklehead across the way that tells me that the reason why he won't invest in my company is he doesn't like the name. You know, it's like, really? Okay, then why are we here? You know? But yeah, I think you know, because it's interesting, because I do mentor younger entrepreneurs, and, you know, of course, they're always looking for advice, and who isn't? Like, I have, you know, mentors as well, and I'm sure you do, where, you know, there's certain things that you don't, certain mistakes you don't want to make. But then there's also some mistakes that, like, I don't think you can avoid making if you're trying to, like, push the envelope a little bit and, you know, try to find your way in the world, right? So, yeah, it's just super fascinating that you had to go through that. I mean, I had a similar story where someone was basically trying to do a coup in the company, and we had to let him go, and he was a co-founder. And it actually was handled quite well by a couple of us, which I was super impressed that it didn't go slide down the path to destruction. But it had all the makings of being that. Like, ooh.
Yeah, there was a badly written contract involved, and, you know, you could interpret it multiple ways, and yeah, I won't go into it, but it was and the investors got involved, so, you know, it wasn't just me and him, it was people who had actually put money in the company, you know, and they got very emotionally involved anyway, so it got pretty bad. We did resolve it in the end, but it was painful and expensive, and stopped me selling the company for about a year, actually. I had a buyer lined up, and, you know, they heard about, you know, as soon as we exposed this to them, they ran for the hills.
Yeah, I can imagine. No one wants that kind of baggage. No one wants that kind of baggage. So do you think within the next, I mean, how do you think your business is going to go in the next 6 months, you know, after COVID, after we sort of get back to normal? Do you think that there's been some sort of sea change in the way people are going to act and how that may impact what you guys are doing?
That's a good question. We haven't seen a slowdown at all, even on the non-social distancing technology. We're very active in oil and gas right now, and I thought that market would just freeze up completely in sort of March. Rather the opposite. The guys we're working with is like, now's the time for us to accelerate and then come out of the slump with something that's so much better than the competition. You know, we dominate, and that's pretty much what's happened. I mean, they're in a very, very strong position through adopting our technology in many different areas of their business. Apart from that, when you're on a, you know, growth curve that's so steep, it's hard for me to notice if it's slowing down 10-15%. You know, we're seeing a lot of activity in manufacturing. I think companies are going to have to look at remote maintenance, remote working, not just, you know, knowledge workers. They're going to have to look at ways that they can do, instead of sending that maintenance crew out to the site, if you can do 20-30% of the time, that maintenance crew can do it remotely through collaboration tools. I think that's going to be more looked at more strongly. Yeah, tough to say. I haven't seen a slowdown. I've seen an acceleration. Obviously, social distancing is a whole nother new sort of market that's just suddenly fallen on us without us even really looking for it. But we're seeing strong activity in agriculture. We're seeing strong activity in manufacturing. I got a little bit of medical stuff starting to happen. So I can't comment on the broader economy. I think people will be looking at ways to you know, reduce travel and reduce having to work on site. But I actually think the economy is going to rebound pretty strongly from this. We didn't destroy an asset class like we did in 2008.
Yeah, that's true. It seems that way to me too. I mean, what I've, you know, what I think is wise, you know, if you're an entrepreneur and you can have the means, is during a crisis building to be ready for when, you know, it really starts to accelerate in the good way, right? And I think it's a great strategy to have. I mean, that's the strategy Intel would have. You know, during a downturn, they'd build factories to be ready to go. And that's why they dominated so much. I mean, even Cypress did that, where during, the 2000 crash.
Yeah.
they are like, well, we're just going to keep building product, you know, keep the factory going. And everyone's like, you know, okay, like maybe this will work. And I just remember, and, you know, to TJ's credit, the guy is hard to work with, like hardest.
Oh yeah.
Probably one of the hardest bosses I've ever had. And he wasn't even my boss. I was like three levels down from him, but you know, my boss's boss's boss. But I would say that, you know, he was a pretty shrewd guy, as well as he's a very like, he would always give us a hard time during good times, and he would always be supportive in the hard time. Like if it was a hard time, he knew we were working hard because he knew, like, you know, he had a heart in that way. And he was, you know, pretty libertarian and pretty, you know, like all about innovation and all that sort of stuff. But they were building during 2000, and some of that stuff they were building would, you know, we ended up not selling, but it was like one of those lessons in how to really strategically figure out what to build and knowing that it'll come back, like it always comes back. I mean, you know, the world will be reshaped a little bit. The nature of work will change. But, you know, we've gone through these things before, and it's just a question of time before it rebounds to something new. And I think the only thing we have to be more considerate of nowadays is how many people get impacted and affected by it, and that, you know, there's people suffering, so we need to figure out how to help them. But yeah, if you're able to build, you need to build now. There's no doubt in my mind. There's no doubt.
We've got six recs open right now. So we're trying to hire as far as, you know, six for us is a lot. That's doubling the teams. So we're in a good spot from that point of view.
That's great. And so is the team you said is all remote. So they all like kind of local or in the Bay Area, or are they just all over the planet?
Right now, they're all in the Bay Area, except we've got one guy over in the UK who we've worked with for a couple of years and is really great at doing embedded software type stuff. So more on the closer to where you're from, the Cypress, you know, Wi-Fi, the gateways that talk to the Wi-Fi chips. So he's very much a one-man guy who just does all our embedded work for us. And then we are building a team. We're not wedded to the Bay Area. Obviously, the salaries here tend to be higher, but we also want to hire, you know, the best of the best. And without being snobby, the best of the best tend to be in the Silicon Valley. You know, as soon as you get outside of the Valley, there's some very good people, but they're not rubbing in the environment enough to be totally up to the latest technologies usually. I think we will round the team out with some Eastern European engineering. We outsource some web development to Argentina because we've got a good team down there, and web development's, you know, fairly well understood, easy to do. We're got a real no real desire to have all the guys in one place. We don't have an office, and we all prefer working from home, and we'll continue to do that certainly until the company gets a little bit bigger. But I think there's good people everywhere, but there is something about the Bay Area and just the talent you can get here. You know, and a good engineer isn't twice as good as a bad engineer. A good engineer can be 500 times as good as a bad engineer.
Yeah. Oh, no, so true. I'm the reason why I ask is I'm just curious how the nature of Silicon Valley will change after all this, you know, work from home. You know, all the big guys, Twitter, Facebook, you know, Uber, I'm sure all these tech companies that are up here and then in the Valley are going to be like, hey, you know, work from home, or however they're going to do it. I wonder if there will be a brain drain from the Valley, or if it'll be like a temporary thing back in like 2008.
It's gone in waves. I mean, you remember 2008 and then 98, 99 during the dot-com boom. I mean, Grass Valley became very popular. Sacramento became very popular. The problem is, it's not really being in an office together. I think that does have a value and can be important. I think it's the fact you're sort of walking into Starbucks and the guy in front of you is, you know, talking about artificial intelligence and writing code while he's drinking his coffee. As you're driving down the freeway, the signs are all about the latest tech, you know, the billboards are all about the latest tech startup. I think there's you just, by being here, you sort of, you know, there's a certain amount of it just permeates into your skin without you even wanting it to.
sort of rubs off.
Yeah. And the only other place I've been that sort of like it really is Tel Aviv.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's very similar. Very, very compact group of engineers in a very small space and a very sort of high-tech environment. I mean, I'm aware that there's other parts of the world that have, you know, got something similar. Austin's pretty good as well. I've been to Austin quite a lot. But I don't think the Bay Area is going to lose its magic. I mean, all the VCs aren't going to move out of town. So they're still going to have meetings in Silicon Valley. I think it'll be a brain drain for a period, but I think it'll bounce back. It always has.
I mean, yeah, I think that's the other thing. It always has. So I think it's hopefully just temporary or well, I don't know. Well,
house prices come down a bit. That'd be okay.
Yeah. I would be in favor of that for sure. I would be in favor of that.
Have some restaurants that are a little bit cheaper and, you know, musicians move back into town. I would be okay with those things.
Yeah. A little more art, a little less, you know, a little more culture, a little bit more back on the culture stuff. So, well, you know, John, it's been great chatting with you. I really appreciate, you know, getting to know you and talking about your journey. And it's nice that we sort of have similar paths and technology and now, you know, decided, well, I guess we're unemployable. We just should do our own thing.
Yeah. That's a good way of putting it.
Yeah. All right. Thanks. Stay safe and good luck.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for listening to the Entrepreneur Ethos podcast. I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did creating it. My hope is that you learned something that can make you a little bit better. If you enjoyed the podcast, please do share it with friends and review it on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. You can also join my email list by visiting theentrepreneurethos.com to get my thoughts on what I'm doing to get better, as well as what I'm working on. You can also pick up my book, The Entrepreneur Ethos, if you want to learn the traits, values, and beliefs that I think we need to build a more ethical, inclusive, and resilient entrepreneur and, frankly, world community. Feel free to follow me on Twitter at TheDailyMBA and let me know if you have any questions or recommendations for a guest you'd like me to talk to. Also, drop me a note if you try anything we talked about on this or any other episode. I'd love to hear what's working for you. Until next time, keep getting better.
Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring this podcast. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System, you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. In hundreds of locations across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's unifiedhealing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE System.